This is the Jabberjaw Podcast Network.
I'm sick with this, I'm sick with this. Since you wasn't the bottom, blood judgment. My own sweet time didn't teach what I thought. I didn't recognize simple things anymore. I don't wanna be defeated, I don't wanna be defeated, I don't wanna be defeated.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to yet another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome. That's the name of my show. I am Shane Told. I am your host. As I talk to other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a band, today we have a very, very special episode. I kind of go back to my childhood a little bit and my upbringing, and I speak to the almighty Rain Maida of Our Lady Peace. Some of you Americans, if you're younger especially, you might not be familiar with the band, but as a Canadian, born and raised in Toronto, they are just the epitome of Canadian music, especially back in the late 90s. Their first two records, Navid and Clumsy, were both massive records, and of course everything after that was huge as well, but that was their start. And they were definitely one of my favorite bands as a kid. And it's funny, you know, I got more into punk rock and stuff like around this time. But Our Lady Peace was always a band that I really, really, really liked and really respected too. Also, Rain has done so much great producing and songwriting. He's one of the top songwriters in the world. He's worked with Pink. He's worked with Avril Lavigne. Crazy stuff. And it's so good to have him. Thanks to Rain for taking the time. Before we get into that, I want to thank everybody who listened to last week's episode with Dustin from Thrice. It's the biggest episode we've ever had. The most people ever listened to that episode. And I really think the last few weeks we've had just so many great guests and people are really latching onto this thing. And I really think what keeps this show growing is word of mouth. So please, if you like the show, tell a friend, tell a loved one, whatever. Just let's spread the word about Lead Singer Syndrome. And I think that that's what's happening. And it's pretty cool to witness right now, just to see this show growing. And, you know, it's just my little thing that I just started 104 weeks ago. And it's really flourished into something special and something that I really enjoy. And I'm so glad so many of you guys enjoy it as well. Also, if you enjoy the show, feel free to go on iTunes and write a review, preferably 5 stars. And of course, we have the All Access Club. Maybe one episode a week is just not enough for you. Maybe you want bonus content with other people. I even interview people that aren't lead singers. We have that. We have interaction with me, interaction with other fans of the show on the Facebook group, Lead Singer Syndrome merchandise shipped to your house. We run contests. We have meetups. So check it out, leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. As little as $6 gets you in. And again, it really is the thing that helps keep the lights on around here, helps keep the show going week after week. Shout out to all my sinners all around the world. Again, the link is leadsingersyndrome.com/allaccess. I want to welcome a brand new sponsor of the show. You probably already know them. You've definitely heard of them, I'm sure. Maybe you've ordered stuff from them before. They've been around for 30 years. They're called Rockabilia, rockabilia.com. They are the world's largest selection of music merchandise. They have everything. They have over 500,000 items to choose from, pretty much everything you can imagine. And it's great if you order from them, you know, you're not just getting the same shirt that everybody's walking around the mall with. They bought at Hot Topic. They have some really, really cool, hard to find stuff. One thing you can rest assured knowing is that all the stuff they sell is officially licensed from the artist. So all the money you spend on their website, the money does get put back in the pockets of the artists. And sometimes you can't be sure. I mean, I know a couple sinners bought me some stuff for Christmas. It was super, super nice of them. I got this Black Flag shirt that was really cool, but looked really cool on the website. But when it got shipped to me from Amazon, it was definitely a counterfeit shirt from China, and it kind of shrunk up to my belly button, which was too bad. So with Rockabilia, you know that's not going to happen. They're big supporters of what I'm doing with the show. We're going to be working with them for hopefully a long time to come. So make sure you go over to their website, rockabilia.com. That's rockabilia.com today and go pick up something real nice. They got all the best deals and all the best stuff. Anyways, let's jump in to this week's episode and my conversation with Rain Maida of Our Lady Peace. And maybe you should sleep. I'm here with Rain Maida of Our Lady Peace. Dude, so good to have you, man. I've been a big fan for like my entire adult life and more. So it's very, very nice to have you. You're calling me from, is it Seattle right now?
Yes, we're in rainy Seattle. Go figure.
Rain and rainy Seattle. There's some joke there. How's this tour been going? I mean, 20 years since Clumsy came out, which was obviously a huge record for you guys. Does it kind of blow your mind that it's been that long?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not one to like reminisce and look back on stuff, but I think there's some value in like honoring it, and I think the fans dig it. But it's been kind of crazy in the sense of when we started the tour, we were literally like doing two sets. Like a Clumsy set, then taking like 10 minutes and switching the stage a bit and coming back and doing like a regular OLP set. And then we were playing new material in the other set, and it just felt like people, like, yeah, they wanted to hear Clumsy, but they also wanted to hear other stuff.
Sure.
Just as much. So we kind of combined the two and cut out a few of the Clumsy songs and started playing more of the newer stuff from Somethingness, which has only been half released, volume's out. But it's been amazing to watch that, like, and people are digging the shows more, so.
Yeah, it's hard to know what to do. You know, my band, we did a 10-year anniversary tour for, you know, our kind of most popular record, and it was the same thing, you know, you don't really know how people are going to respond. And, you know, we did it in order from start to finish, which it makes sense with some records, but it doesn't make sense with all records.
Right.
You know what I mean? And like, some of your tunes are, you know, some of your best songs are early in the record. And it's like, well, if we don't play them to the end, maybe the set just could be better.
Yeah. I also feel like we haven't been to Seattle for 7 years. We played, where was it? Can't remember what city, maybe San Antonio or no, Kansas City. We hadn't been there for 13 years.
Wow.
So I feel like with those fans, like they're hyped about the Clumsy stuff, but they're like, man, we just want to, we've missed like albums of music that we've never seen live. So we want to hear that as well. So
totally.
It's cool. The cool thing about the live show is you can change it every night.
Absolutely. And I love bands that do switch it up. So a lot of respect for you guys for doing that and not just being like, nope, this is it. We're just going to stick with it.
Yeah, totally.
So what kind of fans are coming out? I mean, it must be, you know, you talk about places you haven't played in 13 years, 7 years. Is it people that were, in high school kind of when Clumsy came out? Or do you find there's a lot of young people coming out too that sort of found it up at the record later?
Yeah, it's amazing to meet these kids that are like, you know, in college or high school and are fans of the bands for whatever reason. I think that's just a testament to like the way people consume music, you know. My kids listen to like everything from Tom Petty, obviously, to Kendrick and Post Malone, but like they'll have an AC/DC track in there or like just the weirdest stuff. So I think it's like, it's an interesting time, and I think, you know, bands that are still out there that have been together for a minute are starting to see like a new generation of fans just by virtue of people find stuff in different ways now.
Absolutely, but it also speaks to the just the strength of the songs that are on that record. You know, the timelessness of that record, and I mean, that's got to be a big part of it too.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, I guess I think there's something to be said for, you know, having had a record like Clumsy that did hit and connected with people and then still making new music as well, because I think that feels for for a new fan, it's like, oh, wow, and there's stuff that I can experience right now that's fresh, too. So you're getting it on both, you know?
Well, totally. And as an artist and as a savvy band, you're trying to push forward. I mean, I think it's great to celebrate your past and your legacy and the albums that make you you and have brought you to this point. But, you know, with your new record, Somethingness, which is, like you said, half out, which I want to talk about later, I think it's important that your fans that haven't seen you in 13 years know that you're still working. You still have new material.
For sure. Yeah, and we're finding, and even that for the first, because we haven't really toured down the U.S. properly for like 5 years, you know, and Spotify's only been around for like 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
It's amazing to see now, as we release that first volume, people are coming to the shows and they know the songs already, which is so sick. They're not waiting for like a full record. It's like they can get it right away, which is amazing.
No, absolutely. And when you guys, you know, went into doing this tour and you talked about doing it, you know, for you, I'm sure, you know, you have so many great albums and so many songs. Obviously, you can't play, you haven't been playing all the Clumsy songs, you know, over the last 20 years. Was it weird bringing back some of those songs that you haven't played, haven't sang, haven't even maybe thought about bringing them back into the set list? How was that? And were there any specific ones that kind of like, I don't know, made you smile or just sort of, you know, your mind had been changed about them?
Yeah, there are. There's definitely a couple of those which I are like pleasantly surprised by.
Yeah.
And then a couple where it's like, I'm not singing this song.
And those are the ones that got cut.
Yeah. It's just, you know, you can't. We did it in Canada. We did a Clumsy album tour a minute ago. And I grit my teeth through them. And now, I don't know, I'm just not in that place. I just, you know, and it's fine, right? It's like, yeah, that shit happens. You write songs, they make a record. Doesn't mean they're all great, and I'm cool with that. Some of them, like, there's two songs on Clumsy that are terrible. I won't sing them. And I don't want to, you hate to take that away from fans that like the songs.
Yep.
And it's obviously a personal thing. So it is what it is.
And how much of the songs go through some transformation too, you know, like either over time they've transformed or you're extending apart or, you know, changing. Obviously, like things like drum fills will change and stuff, or a little bit of a vocal melody here or there. But like, how conscious of that are you in that side of things?
The ones that we haven't played for a while, like the deeper cuts on Clumsy, we're kind of keeping true to the album form.
Yep.
The ones that we do play, like most nights in the set, Clumsy and Superman's Dead and 4 AM and songs like that, yeah, they've evolved just organically over the years, and I think people are cool with that. And definitely we extend stuff and kind of have fun with it.
Yeah, man. Oh, that's awesome. So talking about the new record, Somethingness, doing it in two parts is pretty unorthodox, I'd say. I mean, sometimes you have, you know, an EP, one will come out, you know, either it'll come out a year apart or there'll be like a concept there. But putting them out kind of at the same time, but not, what's the story there? What's the reasoning?
I think we had a bunch of songs, but I think the idea of us going in to make a record, like spending 6 weeks or even a month on a record, it just felt daunting. So we said, hey, let's pick four that we really dig, that we feel are really ready, and let's go get them. And so we went into Jackson Browne's studio in Santa Monica, which is like really set. It's his private studio, so it's really set up to record live. And for the first time ever, which is kind of embarrassing to say, but we recorded this stuff live off the floor, everything.
Wow.
And it just caught an energy that we've, I guess, been trying to get for a long time as a band, you know. And so that was amazing, and we just felt like, okay, we did it, we mixed it, got a chance to live with it, which is cool. And then the next batch of songs are really just kind of leapfrogging on that energy. And so I like the fact that you can, because when you're stuck in a whole record, sometimes you finish it and you just, it's too much. It's a lot to focus on. It's a lot to concentrate on.
Yeah.
It's a lot sometimes for me to like write 10 really or 11 great songs with lyrics, like depending on where you're at in your life, like, you know, it's a lot to come up with. So I just liked having a minute away from these four songs and getting perspective. And now I think the new batch is actually stronger, which is really cool to say.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I some of my favorite bands, some of my favorite things, you know, releases they've put out have been EPs. And I feel like just as a band, it's a lot easier to focus on, you know, 4, 5, 6 songs and do a great job on that and put it out. And you know, I don't really know when somebody decided, oh, well, full-length record, it's got to be 12 songs and 40 minutes long.
Right.
And it's got to come out every 2 to 3 years. It's like, wouldn't it be great if your favorite band just put out an EP of 6 songs every year instead? Like, I would love that.
We're starting to feel that way. It's a, like you just said, like, it's a lot to think of 12 songs or 10 songs. Like, I just kind of, I start to sweat when I think about trying to do that in one, you know. It was a different time, you know, 15, 20 years ago, but it, even now, just for art's sake, it's like, you don't want to, A, you don't want to force something. And it's funny talking about Clumsy and some song. I think that's why, right? It's like, we had to put a couple songs on there probably that we didn't love, because we had to go back on the road again, you know, and that whole cycle. And we're just over it now, which is great.
No, absolutely. And Live Off the Floor is such an interesting concept. And, you know, I know you've done a lot of studio work, a lot of writing, a lot of producing. That's kind of been a big focus of your career over the past, geez, I don't know, at least 15 years. Now, when you decide to do that as a singer of a band, of a rock band, isn't it against your better judgment a little bit, in that if you were producing a record with, you know, a younger band or something, you'd probably advise against a band doing it like that?
Yeah. I mean? I kind of did. Yeah, and I did along the way. Like, it was very rare that I would take on a full record with even some of the bands that I was developing. Like, we did EPs, and sometimes it was like 3 songs. And I feel like that, I mean, it's just, it's really probably the way, I think that's what it was like in the 40s and 50s, right? You put out singles.
Yeah.
You know, and you go tour on a single. And you're right. Like, whenever the long form album came in, because of vinyl, I guess. But even like Zeppelin, like, a lot of those records, like 7 songs, 8 songs. So,
mm-hmm. True.
I think we got into this. Yeah. We got into this maybe bad space for a few decades where you're trying to put 60 or 70 minutes worth of music on something. And it's not really, it's probably the one art form where, you know, you got pigeonholed into probably pushing the boundaries of the art too far.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I remember reading like a Metallica interview back in the day, and it was like Lars Ulrich talking about how, oh, we need to give the fans like the most for the money. So this is why we write like 8-9 minute songs. And this is why, I think it was their record, like Load or something, was like to the second, the longest that could fit on a CD.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like, just because it's like that doesn't mean it's necessarily better. And as a Metallica fan, I'm going to say Load is definitely not their finest hour. But I mean, you know, I think that nowadays people aren't consuming CDs. People aren't consuming that. People aren't like, well, what can my, you know, Canadian prices back in the mid 90s, like, what can my, you know, $17.99 get me? Now it's like, well, I want to hear a great song and I want to stream it over and over again. So it really changes the whole dynamics of what you're trying to do as an artist.
Yeah, it's true. You're right. In terms of people's attention spans and stuff, like, an album is really tough for people to get their heads around in terms of, I listen to albums, but like, I've been listening to the War on Drugs. I really dig that band. I can't get through a whole, like, it's tough for me to even find the time to sit through a whole album. You know what I mean? Unless I'm like driving to Vegas or something. Like, it's rough. So I agree. I even like this thought of like 3 songs every once in a while for fans. I think that way you keep them engaged more too. And like, the way things are going, like the way we did this on Pledge as well, just we didn't fund the record, but just some, you know, other items. I love talking to fans, and I think this, you know, having like you said, maybe a few songs or an EP come out every 6 months, like, you just keep that relationship better.
No, absolutely. And you know, you guys being such a massive band, you know, pretty much right out of the gate with Navid and having mainstream success, the fact that you say you love talking to your fans and stuff, like, you come from an era where there was a little bit of mystery, you know, because there wasn't social media. There, you know, like people knew things about you because you told a reporter that wrote about it. You know what I mean? Like, you could do an interview and be like, oh, I really like this kind of cookie. And then the next thing you know, kids are throwing cookies at you on the stage. It was that kind of a thing. And now I know, like, you were a few minutes late for this because you were doing a VIP meet and greet. And that's kind of something that probably didn't happen as much. Is that something you enjoy? Do you enjoy getting that perspective kind of right from the horse's mouth of, in terms of the people that are going to listen to your music?
I do now. Yeah, I used to be much more insular as an artist, like, earlier on. And I think now there's like, that's what keeps us going, you know, like the having being independent, you know, doing deals with labels on our own terms now.
Yeah.
It's just, I just love that direct to fan connection. So again, I don't give everything of myself to them, but I do love the fact that we get to sit and talk to people. You know, we do follow social media. I'm not like, you know, I'm not on it all the time, but there's a lot of value in that. And ultimately, that's who we're playing to, is those people that are following us on Instagram and Twitter. And it's an amazing relationship that we're just lucky we got to live through both, because
Totally.
It's tough when you have to start from the beginning in this way.
Oh, I know. And that's like, even today I was doing an interview and somebody asked me, what's your advice for up and coming artists? And literally my response is, I don't fucking know.
Yeah, right.
I would have no idea what to do now if I had to start. Like, I know what you don't do. Like, you don't do what we did. You don't make a for you guys it was a tape, I'm sure, but, you know, burn a CD on your computer and send it to every label and send an 8x10 glossy. You know, that's like definitely what you don't do. But you're right. It's almost impossible to know what to do now. As a band, you're really right.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I don't even know. If you're gonna get in the music business now, man, you better love it, right?
Yeah, that's true. Speaking of the music business, obviously you're married to Chantel K. I don't know how to say her last name, so I never do. I just say
K. I like that. That's good.
Yep. Well, I don't want to fuck it up, so I know I can say the letter K. And that's been a very, very kind of a, I don't know, relationship that I think a lot of people in the music industry can look up to. Obviously, you've been together a long time, and you've had a really awesome working relationship, too. And you have children, three children, and all that. How has that been with her in your life? And if you want to tell the cute story how you met, feel free. But how hard is it to separate a marriage where it's like, okay, we've got kids, and we've got bills, and we've got a house, and we've got these things, but also we're going to work on music together, whether it's you know, songwriting for other people, or, you know, your new project, Moon versus Sun.
Oh wow, Shane, you're in it, man. You got it all.
What do you mean?
You did your homework. It's
good. Come on, I do this all the time. You're episode 104. Okay.
There you go. But are you on the road right now too?
Yeah, I am. I'm actually laying upright in my bunk on my bus.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
I'm in Calgary, yep.
Oh, you are? Sick. You know what? It's like, I think for me, it's been easier to be in this line of work when your spouse is as well, because just, you know, understanding the light. It's not everyone gets it, you know? I mean,
yeah.
You're in it, you know, you're touring now too. It's like, we've been out for a month now, and I have kids at home, but she gets it, and she'll go do her thing, and then Moon vs. Sun is like a good way for us to finally, after 20 years, like, do something together.
Sure.
That's, you know, rather than writing for someone else. So I just think, yeah, it's made it easy in a way, even though it's you know, you have two crazy artists in a house, but yeah. Ultimately just understanding what each other's going through on, you know, because your creative side, you know, especially as a singer, it's like writing is kind of a non-stop thing. So sometimes you'll be in the middle of something and be like, oh shit, I have an idea, I have to leave. I don't know if most people would understand that, you know?
Right, totally. Well, you guys must have some pretty cool guitars kicking around the house at least.
Yeah, man, our house is just one big studio, really. I've kind of got it rigged that way. I have it all wired that way too, because we have a couple pianos in different rooms and we have a real studio, but it's just kind of, yeah, it's amazing when you're just, if you have an idea, to be able to go capture it right away.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I just can't imagine. I've never really dated or been with somebody that's like a musician like me. And you're very right about that. Like understanding, oh, this is the tour schedule. These are the, this is what I got to do. And it's like, you could say something like, oh, and she, you can call your wife after the show, and she might ask you how it goes, and you'd be like, oh man, like my in-ears were like cutting out. I was like getting like RF, like really bad, and like things like that. So that is actually a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it helps. It just makes all that, like the stuff you're just talking about, it's like, it's a non-starter where you don't have to like explain it. It's just people get it, which is cool.
Absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the production work you've done and, writing, I guess writing and producing kind of go hand in hand up to a point. But first I want to talk about you producing Our Lady Peace Records. And obviously I know you worked with some big names, that probably taught you a lot, but what is it like when you decide, okay, and either you decide or you and the band decide or you and the, like, there's a few people that make that decision when you say, okay, I'm going to produce my own band. How difficult is that to really kind of, see the forest for the trees when you're the singer and the writer and also the producer?
Yeah, I mean, I think early on, like through Spiritual and Happiness, those two records, I was kind of co-producing anyway. I was just heavily involved with everything, all the details. After making Naveed and Clumsy, I guess there was a little bit of osmosis, obviously, when you're in the studio, but I really took an interest in terms of sounds. Mm-hmm. and just tones and trying to figure out like where we should exist. And so I got into that really early on. And those two records after Clumsy, the Spiritual and Happiness records, I don't even know if I was listed as a co-producer with our producer Arnold, but definitely was. The band kind of knew it. And then, and then we made a big switch to Bob Rock, who was like producer guy.
Right.
So it was another, it was kind of a left turn for us. And it was another learning experience. But Bob, I really liked because he started as an engineer in Vancouver, what he did until before he was producing. So he really, he was a guy who was like, if you wanted to get like that Eddie Van Halen guitar sound or the, the Edge guitar sound or the way Bono recorded vocals or some AC/DC,
you definitely
crazy
don't want that.
No, but Bob kidding. Was like, Bob could get whatever you wanted. It's right. Like you put up a record, you put up like a record by Bauhaus and he'd be like, oh yeah, I have that amp. I know I have that, whatever crazy amp that they used to record it, or the Smiths, or it was just like, fuck man, you're incredible. So yeah, he was really cool and learned a lot from him. And then just when we moved on from Bob, it just felt like, look, it's time for us. Really was more about like getting back to just trusting ourselves as artists and not having anyone else in the room. That's kind of why I took on those duties. And the last couple records, we were with a really good friend of mine, Jason Later, who is like Rick Rubin's right-hand guy and does a lot of production on his own. So it's, I just think we're all in it anyway. What the title is, I don't even know what that means anymore. We're all kind of, the whole band's in on it now.
Yeah, that's true. And I think obviously like a producer can mean a lot of things, right? A producer can be a guy that literally just sits there and tells you how the song should go, or whatever, or that was a good take, that was a bad take, do it again. Or a producer can be like kind of the, pretty much the engineer too. Or sometimes the engineer can be kind of be the producer. So everyone does take on different roles at any point, in the recording process. Damn, Bob Rock. No, I mean, I remember being a kid watching those Metallica Year and a Half in the Life, VHS tapes with Bob Rock and stuff. So it's like if I ever met him, I think I'd freeze up and I'd have so many questions. But the first question I would ask him is, what the fuck is up with the snare drum on the St. Anger record?
Yeah.
You can get any tone you want. You just said, Ray, you can get any tone you want. And that was what he decided. The trash can lid.
That's so funny. Well, I mean, we were around for all that. When we were making the second record with him, he was getting all the edits from the DVD or the documentary they did. And
oh yeah,
we were hearing St. Anger like stuff, and I think they just they just wanted to do something live, and it was so different and so outrageous. They decided to go with it, but yeah, a lot of people didn't like it. It was hard to listen to.
It was very hard to listen to. You talk about the War on Drugs record being hard to listen to. Like honestly, like that should be like a bet or a dare. Like someone, if you can listen to the Metallica record Saint Anger like three times in a row without stopping, like, you know, like I'll give you like, you know, $1,000 or something.
That's hilarious.
I don't know if it's possible.
Yeah, I think it was probably a dare for each other. Like, that's why they decided to do it. Like, they each dared each other to release it, and no one blinked, so they did it.
I think so, man. So you brought Navid. You know, your first record. Everyone's first record is the same. Is the same story. You know, you got all these songs from way back, and you know, you try to put them together, and you have demos, and you got to remake the demos, and all this stuff. And of course, like, you don't know what the hell you're doing. But one story that I thought was really interesting that I read was about the title track, Navid, and how it was a song that came late in the process. You wrote it, you know, during your pre-production session, and it became your favorite, but you didn't get much love on that song from the record company, etc.
Yeah, for sure. It was like that was a song for me that I felt like, okay, we're ready to make a record in terms of, you know, just having like a key song that you just felt like, if this is what people hear from us, I'm good. Like, I'm really proud of this.
Yeah.
Like, it just felt like, okay, this is where we need to go. But we finished the record and like no one said anything about that song. And I remember like not fighting with our label because, you know, we were a new band and I was, you know, you're listening a lot, right? I knew what I felt about it, but it's like, okay, everyone likes a song called Starseed.
Yeah.
All right, I felt like Starseed was like
poppier,
this pop
maybe.
Song.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, a little poppier.
I felt like it's this pop song. I said, we don't want to do that. So we had this huge, like, not fuck you meeting, but it was like, okay, we're not going to put Starseed out first. The band's really against it. So they put out this song called The Birdman. I was like, okay, so we're not putting on Navid. And then it took a while. Like, it took a long time for that record to break. But it wasn't until the fourth single, which was Navid, that the record really broke. And
right.
I'm like, see? Like that, like, you know, it really, early on, I felt like, okay, like, not to say I told you guys so, but like, this is what we were pushing for. Finally, it comes out, and that's when everything really blows up. So it's a good thing in terms of like trusting your own instincts.
Of course, and like, imagine leaving that song off the record or just kind of letting, you know, being a young kid and doing what you're told and keeping your fucking mouth shut. Maybe you guys wouldn't. Maybe I wouldn't be talking to you right now because that song was so important.
I believe that 100%. Like, and there, you never know. Like, if we wouldn't have, we didn't really have to fight for it because we didn't really have a lot. We didn't have. I think everything we recorded ended up on the record. It's not like we had 20 songs.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Like no one said a word about that song, so it could easily have got pushed aside.
And it's so strange too. I mean, the record is—it's the title track. Like, you'd think it's an A&R guy's, you know, marketing dream. Like, that's what you want—is a song. It's this song, the title track. Like, this is how good the album is. I mean, that song to me is like pretty undeniable. I mean, it's got like an incredible chorus and like a very cool kind of intro, re-intro
part.
Shane,
yeah, you're bringing up like it's so weird because it was. It's still to this day, like I could visualize sitting in like the studio control room with like our manager and our A&R guy and having these conversations about, because they were all psyched, so hyped about Starseed. I was like, what about Navid? And they're just like, yeah, that's a great album track. It's like, oh fuck, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah, that's funny. And I can relate this to my band too. We had a song, well, our biggest song is called My Heroine, and
yeah,
everyone wanted to leave that off the record except for me.
Oh, for real?
Yep. Yeah. And I ended up getting pushed, you know, down to the B-side of the record, and I really had to fight for that song. And then of course the record comes out, we're not playing it live because no one really likes it except me,
right?
And then, you know, a month later, everyone's freaking out about the song, and it's like, okay. And that was the third single on that record too, you know, because because nobody really thought it was the song. So it's true, like, you got to really believe in your art as an artist, especially as a young artist. And I wonder, you know, I guess this is a question for you as a producer working with or a songwriter, whichever, working with younger artists and bands, do you ever find yourself in that position where where a young artist is like very insistent upon something and you might not get it, but you can almost go back to 1994 and being that kid and be like, you know what? Maybe I do need to kind of respect this artist's, even though I think he's wrong, I might be wrong.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's happened a few times where I've worked with bands where they really dug their heels in on something, and not to the point where it's like deciding between what the first single is, but, you know, things on choruses and maybe having a verse that was like three times too long. But
yeah,
I feel like in this day and age, because it's more in my job, you know, because I'm not like producing Coldplay, I'm usually working with, like, when I'm producing like newer artists, it's like, you know what, you gotta let them have it. It's their art, and you know, it's not the end of the world because they're just starting their careers. So,
do you have any interesting stories about working with, you know, young artists, either with like songs or specific songs or anything that you've done? Because I mean, your list, like I could ask you about specific people, but there's just so many. You know, I just kind of wonder if there's any kind of anecdotes that are, you know,
yeah.
You think
I mean,
of.
I think one of my favorite artists that I ever worked with was Care from Die Mannequin.
Oh yeah,
I'm not sure if yeah. I mean, she was, you know, she was probably the closest thing, and I'm, you know, from like Pink to whoever, but Care walked into our studio and put on her guitar and plugged in and started playing these riffs and singing over them. I was like, holy shit, this is like maybe like what, you know, when Butch Vig sat with Kurt Cobain, maybe. Like, I felt like that.
You felt like that, yeah.
I felt like I've never been in a room with someone with that kind of talent and like confidence and just like, fuck you, this is what I do. Like, it was the guitar was a part of her lyrics were just like out of this world, and you know, it was pretty, it really affected me. I felt like it made me want to get better, if that makes any sense.
Wow. That when was that? I mean, it could have been that long ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago. It was probably like 8 years ago.
Yeah, 8 years ago. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah, wow. Yeah, working. I know you work with Pink and Avril Lavigne and all these people. That is you know, kind of crazy that you single her out. I guess that really speaks to her, you know, her talent. That is amazing.
Yeah, she's incredible.
Wow, that's awesome. So
probably ahead of her time. That's the only problem, I think, well, in terms of like her having a huge career, and that happens, right?
That does happen, and there's so many factors. You know, I mean, there's been so many bands that were going to be the next this, the next this, the next this, in every genre of music. You know, from punk rock to pop to hip hop, and it didn't work out. And there's always that, you're like, you can scratch your head and you can point to certain things, but there are great records, some of the best records that no one's heard, you know, because,
yeah, I mean, even
because
I
of
look
that.
At, I look at our career. I mean, it's like so much of it is luck. My God.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your career is a great example, because you guys coming from Toronto, yep, shout out to the Six, everybody. You know, coming from Toronto, I'm guessing you guys were signed to a Canadian label. At first?
We were, yeah. We signed to Sony Canada
exactly.
first, and
so
then
you
the US picked up on it.
Yeah, you signed, exactly, but obviously it's a lot easier to go the other way. If you're signed to a, you know, a US label first, it's a lot easier to transition into the US. So you guys having just this massive success in Canada, you know, playing arenas and stuff like now, even doing all this crazy stuff, and then, you know, you go to the US and it's like you're playing mid-sized clubs, which is great. I mean, to be doing after 25 years, but obviously, was there some frustration, you know, in those days that you're like, we're this great band, we have this great record, everyone in Canada gets it. Like, why can't it work in the U.S.?
No, I mean, after Clumsy and Gravity, those two records, you know, were both platinum, and I think like the success in the places we were playing then, definitely. I mean, you know, we just. It's a much bigger country, obviously. So
yeah.
I think, you know, and I kind of gauge it by more when I'm looking out on stage in terms of the audience's passion for stuff. So, you know, like that's a good barometer for me. And if, you know, even like tonight, I don't know, we're in Seattle at the Neptune. It's probably 1,400 people, but they'll be singing as loud as an arena, which is like, that's cool with me. That's amazing.
No, totally. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of people dipping down from the Vancouver area as well. But do you have to change it up at all? Like, or do you kind of take the same approach? Because if you're playing at, you know, I don't know, an arena in Canada, or you're playing like, you know, something like that, where you're talking about 10,000 to 15,000 people sometimes, is it different than when you're playing a 1,400, or do you kind of just put on the same show and kind of let the music speak for itself?
Yeah, I mean, even the way we've designed our light show, it really works for whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because even on this tour, you know, there's been some places that are like 3,000 to a place like tonight, which is about half that. And it really, like, we're announcing a tour for March across Canada, which will be in like arenas and theaters, and that nothing will change, which I think is really cool. And I think people appreciate that. It's, they don't, you know, like, no one's getting ripped off. It's not a lesser show.
No, definitely not. Are those going to be more clumsy 20 year?
No, you're leaving that
20 years behind. Otherwhere it would be the 21 year.
This is it. We're going to go cross with Matt Good and do some big shows. So I'm psyched about that.
Oh, I love Matt Good. That's terrific. Yeah. Well, Clumsy will be 21, so Clumsy can be old enough to get drunk. There you go.
Exactly.
Well, in Canada, Clumsy's been drinking for a while, but a couple things before I let you go. I want to ask you about this new record, part two. Is it finished? When is it coming out? Of something new?
It's pretty much done. I was actually just listening to a mix this afternoon. Probably the last song that's being mixed. So it's done. We just got to get it into the streaming services, so probably, and it gets busy with Thanksgiving and Christmas, so it'll be like first week of January, I think, second week of January.
Oh, cool. That's a great time to put out a record. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Another thing that you know, you're really known for is you know, all your work with charity. You know, you've done so much, you and your wife especially. I know your ongoing work with War Child and stuff is important to you, but what else have you been working on that front? And is there anything you can kind of plug for people to check out? I mean, the world right now, I'm sure we could do a whole nother podcast about that. But I just kind of want to know what your focus is on right now in terms of your efforts, you know, for philanthropy and charity.
Yeah. I mean, War Child is kind of always, my wife just did the first real gala for War Child in Toronto a couple of weeks ago. They raised $500,000, which was amazing. So we're always involved in War Child because we're just like so close to that.
And talk to the, can you explain a little bit what that is? Because some people might not know.
War Child, it's a Canadian grassroots charity that has just grown over the years, and they just focus on children that are in war affected zones. So you know, it's really. It's kids kind of are the ones that get overlooked usually in war affected zones because, you know, they're the ones that see the just incredible sadness, but it's hard to get to, you know, the problem with children in those parts of the world is there's the psychosocial effects of war are something that takes a long time to recover from. So, you know, obviously places like that, they need food right away and they need, you know, shelter and all those things, but the mental health aspect of it is so crucial.
Right.
So that's really where War Child is so effective and understands that space really well. And then in terms of where Chantal and I have been putting a lot of focus lately is really on mental health in general. You know, I think that we're seeing it now. I mean, it finally feels like, and Belle's amazing at it, you know, and people are really embracing it. And so it's just, but it's going to take a while to get rid of that stigma. And, you know, we have people within our own family that suffer from it and, you know, bipolar. And it's becoming more common now with people. I even hear people just talking about it more and not being ashamed and embarrassed. And we just go by the model that if one person in a family is sick, then the whole family's sick. And that's how you got to treat it. You know, we don't treat mental health like we do cancer yet. Where if someone in your family gets cancer, everyone rallies around and wants to help you. Mental health's not there yet.
Right. No, that is the goal. I totally agree with you. And you actually traveled to some of those war-torn countries, didn't you?
Yeah, we saw you know, set up programs in Ethiopia and Sudan and been to Iraq and yeah. So that's why we're so close to Warchild, because I've seen it on the ground. Like, I've seen the programs. Yeah. You know, I've seen the sustainability, the way they go about their business compared to other charities. And I'm not knocking other charities, but Warchild sets up stuff that is sustainable, because at some point they do have to leave. But you need to make sure that there's people that are going to take it over that can really run it properly and know what they're doing.
No, absolutely. And I assume there's a link people can check out. But I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's warchild.ca.
Warchild.ca. And that, for our American people listening, that is our very Canadian URL ending. It's .ca. I bet some Americans don't even know that.
They also Warchild.USA, like they run. Oh, okay. Sam Nutt, who runs Warchild Canada, also runs Warchild USA.
There you go. Warchild.ca. Yeah. Warchild.USA.
Yeah.
Dude, thank you so much for taking the time, man. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but new record tour next year. Is that one announced yet, or did you kind of spill the beans on the March Across Canada run?
Yeah, you got it, man. We're just talking about it today, so there we go.
That's amazing, man. Well, that's I'm not going to miss that one for sure. Our Lady Peace and Matt Good, that's going
to
be awesome. All right, man.
Yeah,
well,
come
well
out
thanks.
Say hi, Shane.
Sorry?
Come out and say hi on one of those shows, man.
Absolutely, man. I'll let you know if I can come by. I think I'm home in March, so I'll be in Toronto.
Beautiful.
All right, Ray.
We'll be safe on the road, dude.
You too, man. All the best.
See ya.
Okay, see ya. So there it is with Rain. I want to thank him again and his publicist for setting this up. It really was cool to talk to a guy, you know, 20 years ago, if you'd asked me when I was in high school, if I'd be talking to him on the phone. It just blows my mind. I'm really, really excited for the invitation to go see them in Toronto. That tour's announced. Our Lady Peace with Matt Good, all across Canada, playing some really, really big places. And yeah, go get your tickets, go get your VIP. And of course, be sure to check out all the new Our Lady Peace music that is coming out. It just came out. More is coming out. Very, very, very cool. As you probably know, I always play music on this podcast, and I feel like some of the American listeners might not know this song, and we talked about it a whole bunch. To me, it was just an obvious hit. I think maybe why, you know, now thinking about it and listening to the song again, why maybe Rain's people were like, oh, I don't know if it should be a single, is because it is almost 6 minutes long. But here it is, a great tune, what a chorus. The first song I ever heard by Our Lady Peace. Here is Navid on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love.